Good morning. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. For Chase Peterson, academics is in his DNA. The son of a college president, young Chase grew up on campus in Logan and developed a vast intellectual curiosity. But he also benefited from his experiences baling hay and using the family ranch as a laboratory. Those diverse environments and experiences served him well as he ventured east for prep school, for college, medical school, and eventually as a university president himself. Peterson has written a new memoir, and today on the program he joins us to talk about family, about faith, and about academic freedom. And Chase Peterson joins me in studio. Dr. Peterson, welcome. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Jennifer.
Chase Peterson is a professor of medicine at the University of Utah. He's still teaching half-time. He is a former dean of admissions at Harvard University. He is president emeritus of the University of Utah, and he's author of the new memoir, The Guardian Poplar, a memoir of deep roots, journey, and rediscovery. And he'll be reading from that book on Wednesday, May 30th at 6:30 at Weller Bookworks. That's at Trolley Square in Salt Lake City. We'll give you more details on that as we go. Later on in the program, we're shifting gears, talking about fostering creativity with art access. But first, Chase Peterson. If you have questions or comments about Chase Peterson's life or the evolution of the University of Utah, you can give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. Or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Dr. Peterson, your memoir is titled The Guardian Poplar. Where does the title come from?
A wonderful painter from Sweden named, I'll think of his name in a second, came out to Utah State to be a visiting professor in summer school for 10 years. And he fell in love with the Utah landscape and I think the Utah sociology, if you will. And he saw these poplars planted everywhere, and especially poplars planted next to pioneer homes. And they appeared to be almost guarding the home. And that he gave my parents a copy of an etching he did called The Guardian Poplar, which is where this comes from.
And it's beautiful, and it's on the cover of your memoir. You are now 82.
Yes,
and,
sir.
And you've accomplished so much as an academic, as a practicing physician, a church leader. At this point in your life, why write a memoir?
Oh, that's a wonderful question, because I've never been a writer. I've been a talker, incessantly probably. But I've never been a writer. In fact, I used to even kind of avoid classes in college that had a long-term paper at the end. So I was kind of scared of it. But I was at a testimonial meeting for Spence Eccles a number of years ago, and I was asked to speak briefly. I did, and the next day I got a phone call from a man named Sidney Hyman, who was a professor of English at the University of Chicago. And he had been the biographer of Mariner Eccles, who was one of the early Eccles leaders, head of the business administration aspects of the Depression under Franklin Roosevelt. And he said, "Dr. Peterson, I heard you last night. I want you to know your stories are believable, and you need to write them down and start doing it right now." It's kind of an interesting order
to get from
someone I never had known before. And I thought about it and didn't do too much about it, but it sort of stuck in the back of my mind. Then I had a wonderful fellow at the University of Utah, Greg Thompson, come to me and wanted to do an oral history just for the university archives, facts and figures and so forth. So we did that. When he gave the rough draft back to me, I realized it was very rough and it would take a lot of editing to be what I would be sort of proud of. And I thought, well, good heavens, maybe I should write it myself. And I started to fumble around and write a few things, and some people told me that I should screw up my courage and send a few pages to David Cranes, who was a wonderful professor of English at the University of Utah, just in the act of retiring at that time. And I sent it to him, sort of a little nervously. And I got it back in a few days, and he said, "Peterson, you got something here. It's going to be hard, but you got to do it." And I was pleased to hear that, even though it was terribly emphatic. He said, "And by the way, could I make a suggestion? Try using commas and paragraphs time to time." And I was startled me because I said, "Well, what are you talking about?" "Of course I do." I looked back at what I'd sent him, I had a whole page with one comma in it. And I then realized that in speaking, you don't say, ladies and gentlemen, comma, I'm here this evening to be with you, to comma, so forth. You do it with inflection in your voice and so forth. But on paper, it's got to stand for itself. And I enjoyed the process of learning how to write. So I started doing this, and I would write it. The computer became a friend, because in a computer, you can write your ideas down quickly, but not perfectly. And then you can come back and edit and make them, tone them up right and so forth. But, oh, I found it so satisfying. I would go to the office at 4 o'clock on a Saturday afternoon with no one around. It's up in Research Park. And I'd look at my watch, and it's 11:30 at night. I haven't been to the bathroom. I haven't had any food. I haven't called home. I've just been absorbed in this business. And so I began to discover more and more of my roots in looking backwards. And my ancestors, Peterson, came from the island of Bornholm, off the coast of Germany and Denmark. And a few years before, my wife and I had visited that home, trying to track down a little bit about them, and found just one reference in the local Lutheran church. Now, they had converted to the Mormon church off the streets of Bornholm. But in this little note in the Lutheran church, 1854, gone to America. And indeed they had. They'd come to find Zion in America.
Why did you decide to start your story well before your time, going back to the ancestors who crossed the plains and eventually settled here in America?
Well, because I began to think to myself, good heavens, I've got some DNA there. Not just biochemical DNA, but I've got some educational, emotional, historical DNA. They went up to Baker City, Oregon to get jobs when they got out here. And my family all pretty much worked in the David Eccles sawmill. This was the son, the father of Mariner Eccles. And they were never rich. They worked hard, and my grandfather worked in the farm, in the mill, my dad did as well. But the word got around town that my grandmother was trying to save money for a certain reason. And on the way to church one day, and Mariner Eccles told me this story. I never heard it from my parents until they confirmed it later. David Eccles, owner of the mill, put his arm around my little short grandmother, said, Sister Peterson, what's this I hear about you working your fingers to the bone, taking in boarders and doing laundry to save money to send your children to college? Why, I'm not even sending my boys to college. My grandmother looked up at him, said, Brother Eccles, if I had your boys, I wouldn't either. Now, there's the American dream. You could be poor or medium poor, but there was always opportunity.
And education was highly valued in your family. Your father was
a university
president of what is now called Utah State University. And you grew up on campus.
Well, you see, and that then began the notion of what was home. And remember the phrase that it takes a village to raise a child? Well, I don't know if it took it required, but I certainly was raised by that campus. I love the Utah State campus. I'd roam that campus in the summer and other times. I just felt I belonged. I marched with the marching band when they practiced. I went with the farmers that went out to feed the cattle in the North Logan. I joined up in the painter crew and helped them with little errands and things. They let me paint a little bit here and there. I was 6, 7, 8, 9 years old. I was with the painters so long, I went every day, that I figured, well, I guess maybe I've been hired. And when payday came once a month, there was a certain office window you went to in the old main building. I went over, got in line for my paycheck. And I was about 4 feet tall, and I stuck my head up above the window and gave my name. And they said, well, we don't have anyone by that name here on salary. And I walked away, and I was a little disappointed, but that was all right because I just enjoyed doing it. Well, that was the beginning of a sense of home. And I guess it grew when I was in the 9th grade in junior high in Logan. The principal came to see me and said, Chase, Would you be interested in taking a test? There's a school back east that wants some people out here to take a test. They might give them interest and have them go there. I said, well, if I'm not obliged to do so, I'd be glad to take it. I enjoy tests. So I took this test, and a month later, a telegram came. And a telegram in those days was a big deal. It was delivered by hand, by a messenger. And it said, I've been awarded this scholarship to a school called Middlesex School in Concord, Massachusetts. Well, Dad and Mother checked out the school and everything else, and they found it was a very good school. And they sort of presumed I'd be going, but I thought it through. Dad was leaving the presidency of Utah State after 29 years, one of the longest terms any president's ever had. And we'd lived in a college home all that time and didn't have any home equity. So they had to buy a house to live in. And his retirement funds were probably pretty slim because they had not grown much during the Depression. And I thought, well, I think it would be a strain on the money, family money. They didn't complain about it and never told me that. But I told Dad, I think I don't really want to go. And he had a letter written thanking them and declining. And he brought the letter over from his office, and he leaned against the fireplace. I've never forgotten this moment. It changed my life. He read the letter to me, and then he simply said, Chase, are you sure you don't want to go? And for reasons I will never understand, I said, Dad, as a matter of fact, I do. And he took the letter and just tore it up in two. Just tore the paper, literally, physically in two. Didn't say, are you sure, or do you want to think about it, or watch out for the painted ladies in Chicago when you change trains. If I wanted to go, he was behind me. A father has never given a son a greater vote of confidence than that, and I was going to darn well, even damn well, not going to let my father down when I went. So I went off to Middlesex, and here's a new culture. New England's very old and is proud of its cultures. Emerson, all these folks, the Stonewall that started the Revolutionary War. I wondered how I would fit in, and I really felt like I was, well, I don't want to sound pompous, but I was a Mormon boy. I didn't know what that meant, really, but I was one. And I was the first Mormon and first Utah to ever go to this school. And I was not going to let that, I wasn't going to let my church down or my family down. And there it started. Well, finally, I ended up going to college, and I applied to three places, Harvard, Yale, and Utah State Agricultural College, which is now Utah State University. And I chose to go to Harvard for reasons, whatever. And I had a class in the sophomore year that was to study the Harvard Business School cases, not for the economics, but for the human relations. It was a small class of 10 or 12 kids. And we got to know each other very well because we sort of exposed ourselves and our backgrounds in talking about these human relations. And one day, walking to class with the teacher, we got talking about being homesick for some reason. And he knew about me leaving home when I was 15 or so. And I said, well, you know, Professor Cabot, it's funny. I don't ever remember being homesick. And without a pause, he says, of course not, Chase. You brought your home with you. And that really was profound to me because I had not thought about that, but that's exactly what I'd done. And I began to realize that I could have my home and I could have my standards and I could be me. And I could go to new places and absorb and enjoy the new cultures, and it'd take all there was to get from them without losing what I had come with.
Dr. Chase Peterson, he is President Emeritus of the University of Utah, still a half-time professor of medicine at the U, former Dean of Admissions at Harvard, and the author of the new memoir, The Guardian Poplar, a memoir of deep roots, journey, and rediscovery. He'll be reading from that book on May 30th at Weller Bookworks in Trolley Square. More information is on our website, kcpw.org. But if you'd like to join us, if you have memories of working with Dr. Peterson during his time as president of the University of Utah, if you have comments about his about his interactions with Dr. Barney Clark, or about questions about cold fusion or shanty towns on the University of Utah campus, give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255, or send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. We need to take a break. We'll be right back. This is City Views on KCPW Salt Lake City. Welcome back. This is City Views. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce. We're talking about curiosity, ingenuity, sincerity with the former University of Utah president, Dr. Chase Peterson. He's written a new memoir titled The Guardian Poplar. And if you'd like to join us, 801-355-TALK is our number. If you've worked with Peterson or have questions about his defense of academic freedom in the cold fusion controversy or medical or his medical practice, give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number. So much of your experience is tied in with your with your academic career, but you actually started out as a doctor. You specialized in endocrinology, and you'd been in private practice for about 5 years when you got a phone call from Harvard University. Were you actively pursuing an academic career?
Not at all. I thought I was back here to live happily ever after. Loved my practice, loved my colleagues working with them, and did part-time teaching at the medical school. Telephone rang. I had a male patient on the table, stripped down to the waist, examining him. Took the phone call in another room. It went on longer than I expected, and my patient was a little annoyed with me when I got back, having been sort of chilled without a shirt on. But it was from a friend at Harvard who'd called to say, Chase, would you be interested in being dean of admissions at Harvard College? And I said, well, no, I'm a doctor. Well, we went on and talked about it and so forth, and I became a little bit curious about it. It made no sense, but I still was kind of curious. So I went back. And I met with President Pusey of the university at that time and these other friends that I had and known. And one thing led to another, and after a couple of weeks of talking and negotiation, they offered me the job. And I thought about it and said, you know, I really can't do that. I can't abandon this, my career that I've spent all this time learning about. Thank you so much. Chase, you don't sound like you're totally convinced. Let me think about it for a week and I'll call you back. Well, during that week, my wife and I continued to talk it over. We prayed about it. We did all the things we could do to amass any wisdom out of this matter of decision. We were at a dinner party one night during that week, and Sip said, Chase, what's this cockamamie idea I hear about you maybe going back taking some job at Harvard? Are you going to do that? I looked across the table at my wife. We had not actually shaken hands on a deal, but we were very much in sync emotionally and intellectually. And again, for the same reason that happened before, with Middlesex, I took a deep breath and said, well, as a matter of fact, we are. And my wife had a glass of cranberry juice in her hand. And she went, oop, and spilled some of the red cranberry juice on a white couch she was sitting on.
Ooh.
And we insisted on paying to get the couch cleaned as best we could. But off we went. And back there, then the challenges came. The first week I was there, the Boston Globe, which is the main newspaper in Boston, I had a full-page article on the second page of the front section about this new dean of admissions at Harvard. Now, you wouldn't think it'd take so much noise about that, but it's a big deal back there because people have gone to Harvard for generations and generations. They darn well want their son to go to Harvard and who's the new dean and all the rest. And then the article concluded, the church Chase Peterson belongs to does not admit blacks to its priesthood. Will he admit blacks to Harvard?
Talk about that.
Whoa.
The role. I mean, this was a very turbulent time.
Oh, 1967.
Yes.
Martin Luther King had just died around that time. And I'll tell you, that hit me right in the chest. And at first I wanted to get up and say, I'm blah, 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 blah. I wanted to defend myself. And then I realized there's nothing I could say. I was proud of being a Mormon. I disagreed with the Mormon program of no priesthood for the blacks, and I thought it was going to change, and there was a lot of evidence that it probably was going to change. But nevertheless, I said to myself, Peterson, you're not a bigot. Do your job. People will discover who you are sooner or later, and it'll be okay. Well, it worked out wonderfully. We were being pressured at that time to establish quotas for students of color to come in, to be admitted, on the assumption that the sins of the past had to be compensated for, and this is the way to do it. Well, I said, no, we're not going to have a quota. There are plenty of black people out there that are perfectly qualified to do the work at Harvard. They just don't think of Harvard because their grandfather and father and uncle and aunt or second grandfather didn't ever go to Harvard. And if we can find the right ones, they'll be just fine. And by golly, we did that. And we found wonderful kids. And they would come in and get C's and D's maybe if they came from bad backgrounds in their freshman year, and B's and A's in their sophomore years. And one of the wonderful fellows that writes a foreword for my book, Cornel West, came in one of those first classes, black student from the wrong side of the tracks around San Francisco, and he did exactly that. By junior year, he was getting A's, graduated with honors from Harvard, got his PhD in 3 years at Harvard, and has been a Princeton professor ever since. The country was looking to see what affirmative action ought to be, and the Supreme Court took two cases called a Bakke case out in California and University of Michigan a little bit later. And bless their hearts, they quoted our admission standard program, saying this was appropriate affirmative action. More effort can be spent looking for the right people, but they still had to pass the same criteria to be admitted. Hmm. And that's what we did. And so no black student ever came to Harvard felt that he had a stamp on his back saying he was the 14th out of 18 we had to take. It would have been an insult.
Sure. You spent much of the 70s at Harvard, and then you got another phone call to come back to Utah.
Even better than that, I was a dean for the 6 or 8 years, and then the new president of Harvard asked me to be a vice president with him. And I did that for 5 or 6 years, and by that time I wondered, am I ever going to get back to Harvard, to Utah, or medicine? I went down to Cape Cod for a month every summer and practiced as a general practitioner on the Cape. So I did have my finger in medicine, but the call came from David Gardner, who was the president of the University of Utah at that time. And bless his heart, he encouraged me to consider being a vice president for the health science area of the university. And we talked about it and realized that if we didn't go back to Utah and back to medicine now, I was getting older, we probably never would. It was time to go back. And John Dixon had been my predecessor there and was one to have time to do more research. He came back, we talked about it, we accepted the job and came out here and never regretted it ever since.
Speaking with Dr. Chase Peterson, President Emeritus of the University of Utah, he continues as a half-time professor of medicine at the U, and he is author of the new memoir, The Guardian Poplar. If you'd like to join us, 801-355-TALK is our number. Your profile as university president at the U was really raised with the artificial heart surgery that involved Dr. Barney Clark. He was a dentist from Seattle. Describe your role in this landmark procedure and some of the ethical issues that were surrounding the surgery that you talk about in your book.
This was pioneer work in a lot of different ways. We had this brilliant Pim Kalf who'd come out from Holland to Utah, was interested in artificial organs, invented the artificial kidney, and now was working on artificial heart. The word came out that the Food and Drug Administration had approved the use of the artificial heart in a test patient, having been put into dozens and dozens of calves and other animals and worked well in that area. And the word got around that we were about to choose somebody to do this with. And gosh, the whispering going on around the university was enormous. And this public relations people came and said, Chase, we've got to figure out how to handle this because we can't do this research in a lab off in the corner and write a paper about it 6 months later. They're going to demand to know what's going on and how are we going to handle that? Well, I called a meeting. I was vice president of the health science area. I called a meeting of all the people being involved, the doctors, the people that ran the pump, the nurses, the people that ran the elevators, the janitor, the financial managers of the hospital who would pay for it and so forth. and said, tell me what each of you will be doing, do you think, in this process? Because we're going to be looked at and watched very closely. And they said the routine things. Yes, we're ready as surgeons. Yes, we're ready as the pump people. We got to the nurses, and a wonderful woman named Linda Gianelli spoke up, head of nursing. And I said, are you ready? She said, no, we're not ready. And we said, oh, well, why? Because we don't know how to run the pump. And the doctor sort of patted her on the head a little condescendingly, saying, don't worry, honey. We'll be there to pump, to take care of the pump. Like hell you will. You'll be out on the John when that pump stops, and he'll be dying, and he'll die on our floor. And if they're in our care, in our nursing service, we need to know how to use that pump. Well, okay, we stopped everything. It took a month for them to learn what had to be done about that, and met again and found we were ready. Well, Barney Clark arrived. He arrived one day, was to be operated on the next day. He was so sick because they had to get someone so sick that he would not lose much if he died, so to speak, and yet healthy enough that he had some chance of surviving the surgery. That was a narrow gap.
So why did he choose to do this?
Why?
Uh-huh.
Because he knew he'd be dead in a week or two. And he also had a feeling of history. He said, I think I'd rather... challenged by the notion of being the pioneer, the first person to receive an artificial heart. So they went into surgery, and a woman named Susan Stamberg, you might know her from NPR. She's got the most compelling voice. If she asked me to tell all my secrets, I would pour them out to her through the telephone. She called about 3 days into that surgery, caught me. I took it on a payphone in the hall. Why is everyone so interested in this heart, Dr. Peterson? And I said, well, we're not entirely sure. It took us by surprise, but we had to prepare ourselves for it. And I said, but if you want me to guess, I would say that it's poetic, that the heart is thought to be, I love you with my heart. The heart is the center of the matter. All these things metaphorically about the heart. She said, well, I think you're probably right. Well, it turns out that Barney Clark had the same feeling. I learned this later, he went into surgery and he turned to his wife and said, honey, her name is Uniloy, I wonder if I will love you when I no longer have my natural heart. And he went into surgery, came out, 3 or 4 days of recuperation, had a tracheostomy in his neck, couldn't speak very clearly, but he looked up at her and said, I love you. He confirmed you could still love somebody without your own heart. But at any rate, we were criticized for doing this in public because, in general, there's a rule in medicine that you should not announce results of things or promote things in the public press until they're well proven and been reviewed and so forth. And this was not proven. This was an experiment. No one had proof of it. So we were criticized appropriately for that. The New York Times editorials thought we were putting on a circus out here. But to our credit, the science editor of the New York Times praised us greatly for saying having pioneered work in how to handle the increasing influence of media or intrusion of media into science. And they said they thought we'd done a very good job. Well, I think we did as good a job as we could. That was the story of Barney Clark, and the research continues. There are now artificial heart assists being used regularly, and there are people working still on full heart transplants.
Another of the major controversies in your administration as University of Utah president, cold fusion. The experiments by Pons and Fleischmann, and you personally took some considerable heat for supporting their inquiry. And in many ways, the University of Utah's reputation was on the line. Why did you decide to continue to support their research in the face of such scrutiny?
There were two congruent principles at stake here. One was academic freedom. That is, a person had the right in academia to have any ideas they wanted, to bring them out and discuss them in the public forum and so forth. The other very appropriate principle is that science should be controlled and disciplined so that every cockamamie idea that comes up doesn't splash out on the headline of the newspapers. You know, carrot juice will cure athlete's foot, but no one ever did any studies to prove it did or not. And so they were in conflict because no one could explain the reason why the electrolysis process that Pons and Fleischmann set up, why it produced so much excessive heat. And it seemed, the only thing that seemed to explain it would be a nuclear fusion process. And yet, if it did, it violated all the rules of nuclear physics. And gosh, you couldn't believe that. They should have been killed with radiation if it was the traditional fusion going on. But there it was. They'd even had an accident in the lab 6 months before. When they left the thing running over the weekend, they came back and it had burned a hole through the glass vessels, through the laptop made of marble, and in the floor there was a hole 7 feet wide and 3 feet deep, 7 inches wide and 3 inches deep, burned in the floor by something. Yet no explosion. It wasn't a hydrogen explosion. The windows weren't burned out. And I know about that 7 inches and 3 inches because I called the assistant to Pons who was with him when he saw this. And he said, you know, I'm surprised Professor Pons didn't seem upset about this. He seemed as if he'd swallowed a canary. I tracked the guy down in Ohio where he's working in a lab now. And he remembered to the day and to the inches that the cement had been burned. I checked that the cement tends to vaporize at 1,700 degrees temperature.
And yet this discovery, I mean, as you point out, it defied laws of physics.
Yeah.
And yet you stood behind them.
Well, there they were. They had legitimate data. And a conference was called in New York in the week after the announcement of some very fine people, 3 or 4 Nobel Prize laureates, sponsored by the National Science Foundation and supported by EPRI, which is the Electric Utility Research Association or something like that. And after 3 or 4 days of reviewing all that had gone on in the lab, they said, we do not understand the cause of this, but we find the science very compelling. We see no errors in what has been done, no errors in what has been reported, and we strongly suggest and recommend that every effort be made to find out the reason, the mechanisms whereby this is working. That report was never published. And you have to wonder why it wasn't published. It wasn't published. But in my book, I list the reference still. You can get it on email or some whatever the term is on your computer. You can dig out a 40-page report that they wrote, but it was pretty much put aside. And we were even criticized for having let that publication occur without peer review, which is a normal, appropriate way to avoid trash going into the publication. Well, it was published by peer review, but the peer review was the Journal of Electrochemical Chemistry, which was Fleischmann's specialty. It wasn't published in the Journal of Physics. Mm-hmm. And the physics people felt they owned that. And a final reason, and put yourself in the shoes of a professor of physics doing research in hot fusion, which was being done, trying to replicate the conditions of the sun to produce fusion on Earth and heat. This was being funded by the Senate. It was promising, but no progress was being made. It went year after year, and we never quite got one to produce more heat than it took to get there. And then these people out in Utah come along and say they are maybe doing something with cold fusion, a much simpler way, whatever the way was. What would that do to the support for the hot fusion research, especially if this cold fusion couldn't possibly be true because it violated the rules? We had a professor at Harvard in OBGYN in 1920s invented a forceps. It was the latest way to pull a baby's head out through the birth canal. And he announced rather pompously that he said, this ends the era of research in gynecology. We've learned all we can learn. Well, 5 years later, they discovered estrogen. So there are new things to discover. Anyway, those are the things that went back and forth. And I was asked to testify in front of the Utah legislature, who wanted to fund this and did, $5 million. And then I was asked to go back and give testimony at a congressional hearing on the matter. And the congressman who introduced the program made the same mistake, that this had been announced without peer review. And I had to correct him on that, although I'm not sure if he accepted my correction. But that was the story. And so you can understand when everyone began to laugh at Utah, and some people said, some of these scientists said, I never take science reports coming from the Vatican or Salt Lake City very seriously, implying that we were kind of religiously different. We had a friend in Cambridge invited people to supper in the week of the announcement. And she called me after that and said, you know, Chase, you'll be amused by this. We had two professors from MIT and one from Harvard in physics at the dinner. We got talking about cold fusion. And the MIT professor says, you know, I think there probably is something to that, but I can't believe if something that large would ever come from a place like Utah. So there you have it. It was a battle, and the work is still going on vigorously all over the world. Labs are still pursuing this. Right now, there's a course being taught at MIT by a professor on possible etiologies for the mechanism for the production of heat in the Pons-Fleischmann system.
You hold a great, you embrace this word, yet.
That, yet.
it hasn't been proven yet.
The mechanisms haven't been proven, and no one has been able to produce one you can stick in your car and make the car run. And maybe never will. It may just be an interesting oddity of science. You remember that when someone said, you know, that Africa and South America are drifting apart. That in the 1920s, people laughed at him, but there was no protest about it. They just put it aside and said, well, that's nonsense. That isn't happening. And then slowly evidence accumulated over 30 or 40 years that indeed they were moving apart. There was drift of these continents. That was easier for something that didn't have a lot of meaning in terms of funding. I talked to the head of the Cavendish Lab at Cambridge, England, one of the great distinguished physics lab in the world. I said, when is cold fusion going to be brought back into the mainstream of medical research? He looked at me, nice man, and he slyly said, well, you know, Dr. Peterson, the hot fusion people have a strong lobby. But a university is a place where ideas like this need to be explored.
We may see that yet. Our time is short, but you left the University of Utah as president in 1991. You returned to practice. You've had rich experience since leaving the academic administration, and many things have changed on campus since your tenure. I'm just curious, finally, what do you think about, you know, the Pac-12, about the campus build-out, about the university's heightened profile in research and athletics?
Well, let me answer that in the context of some people's worries that this embarrassment about cold fusion was going to ruin the university. Well, apparently it didn't. The research we did, the amount of funding was about $140 million back in 1990 when this was done. It's now close to $500 million of research being done. I've talked to department chairmen about recruiting new faculty. We're stronger than ever. The university has never been in better shape. We're the leading university in the number of ideas that are spun out that become companies, head of MIT even in that. Then you want to throw in the Pac-12. That's both important and not important. Athletics don't run a university, but they're an important part of it, and they help generate the sense of community in a university. And it's nice to be recognized because those schools, Stanford, UCLA, University of Oregon, University of Washington, all these are very fine schools. They would never bring a college university in to join their club that they didn't have respect for. So it's a sign of high respect academically as well as athletically. And bless Chris Hill for pushing that over the years. We worked together on it for a while. But it's a nice recognition. But we shouldn't get too wheat up about it. It's just it's a nice additional landmark on the way toward being one of the really fine universities in the United States and in the world.
Again, just very briefly, you completed your memoir. You're now 82. What did you learn from reflecting on a life well lived?
I'm still reflecting, and I don't know how I have to answer that in a few more years probably, But I did learn that my passport that I got from my family was indeed a passport to the world. It was not a restraining order. I could be loyal to family, to family roots, loyal to my church, loyal to these things, and yet I could go out in the world and take all that with me and not be ashamed or intimidated or whatever else. That was part of it. In other words, the world was one great, big, interesting place with lots of things to learn.
Dr. Chase Peterson, President Emeritus of the University of Utah, halftime professor of medicine at the university, and author of the new memoir, The Guardian Poplar. And Dr. Peterson, it's been a pleasure. Thanks very much for your time.
Oh, I'm honored to be with you, Jennifer. Thank you.
Dr. Peterson will read from his memoir on Wednesday, May 30th at 6:30 at Weller Bookworks here in Salt Lake City. There's more information on our website, kcpw.org. Coming up next, we'll switch gears, art for everybody, but first a break. This is City Views on KCPW, Salt Lake City.